Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and this is It's Hot in Here, your weekly dose of environmental news, views, and grooves. I'm one of your hosts today, Jennifer Johnson, and to my right is
David Clive.
And we are very happy to have Pearl Zhang with us as well. Hello, Pearl.
Hi, Jennifer.
How are you on this fine morning, afternoon, officially now?
I'm really good, and I'm just really happy to be back in the studio again.
Excellent, excellent. And unfortunately, our listeners do not have the good fortune of seeing Pearl right now, but she is wearing a gorgeous top with so many lovely floral designs on it, reminding us that it is summer out
there. Spring, summertime.
Spring and summer. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So today we're talking about a subject very close to my heart, which is fish.
And mine. See, I thought that if I just talked about fishing enough on the show that we might be able to do an entire show about it. And that totally worked, and we're doing it.
You hardly, yeah, there was no need to twist any arms as far as I can tell. But I like it. We'll be talking a bit about local fisheries, fish consumption, and some issues in the Great Lakes. So we have the great fortune of being joined today on the phone with Dr. Ed Rutherford, who's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, as well as Dr. Solomon David, a former PhD student and now minted PhD doctor who is working at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. So he'll be joining us on the phone as well to talk about his work. To get us in sort of a strange but fun mood to talk about fish, I think we should listen to a song of the same name, Fish, by Mr. Scruff. Let's do it.
Once again, I shall go and get the fishmonger to prepare the fish.
Yeah.
They live on fish and catch them by diving onto them from a great height. Deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, gliding down through the dark green water. He could breathe underwater because he had amphibious nostrils. On the way down, he passed hundreds of trout of different sizes. Trout are freshwater fish and have underwater weapons.
Don't you go too near.
Trout are very valuable.
Keep away from the trout.
Why should it be that the fish in the sea are all unable to sing?
Just listen to me, young fellow. What need is there for fish to sing when I can roar and bellow?
Oh, hey, that was Mr. Scruff's track, Fish, off his album, Keep It Unreal. And he has quite a few aquatic-themed music in his collection, including stories about fish, whales, and other sea life.
I like that. That was funky.
Yeah, it is funky. He's got another lovely tune, Ahoy There, on his album, Trouser Jazz, which is quite nice as well.
Okay.
If you want to get in sort of a surreal-y thing going on.
Maybe I'll put it on next time I go fishing.
There you go. It might help. Maybe have some headphones, because I'm not sure if fish like that kind of tunes, but maybe they do.
Maybe. I don't know. It might bring some in.
So Dave has got some information on a story about a lake.
We're going to do a little environmental news now, and I'd like to talk about White Lake. It's
White
a lake,
lake
on the west side of the state. And the towns of Whitehall and Montague border this lake. In the 1970s, it was polluted very badly by Hooker Chemical.
What a great name for a chemical corporation.
I know, right? Very safe sounding.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not going to destroy the entire habitat around
no.
where. So anyway, there were vast quantities of salt underground at White Lake, which brought Hooker Chemical to this area. And they produced chlorine, and they eventually started producing this chemical known as C56. Its full name is hexachlorocyclopentadiene. That was there, and it was used as a flame retardant and pesticide, and they were very irresponsible with their waste management in this site. But there's good news on the horizon. It is being removed, or very soon to be removed, from the list of areas of concern. And there are 43 of these areas. And in 1978, the U.S. and Canadian governments signed the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which was basically just to identify areas of concern within the Great Lakes area and try and clean them up. And in the mid-1970s, a whistleblower came forth from Hooker Chemicals talking about the atrocious waste management practices going on there. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the article that I read. Beginning in 1957, Hooker's approach to getting rid of the waste from its C56 operation, that's the hexachlorocyclopentadiene, included dumping them into an on-site lagoon or placing them in 55-gallon drums, taking those drums to a section of the plant's 880-acre property and leaving them there. Yeah, the waste from those barrels would be allowed.
That's just what you did in the 70s.
Yeah,
you know?
I know.
You're like,
yeah,
we got some waste, let's put it in a barrel and pretend like we don't know who produced it.
Yeah, we got some open land over here that no one's ever going to go to again, and we can just leave it there and it's fine.
Sounds good, yeah.
And the waste from those barrels were allowed to leak into the ground from holes cut by axes. But, as I was saying earlier, there is good news on the horizon. It is close to being removed from the list of areas of concern because of the cleanup acts that have really been happening there recently. And I just thought that would be a nice sort of silver lining story to start the show with.
That's exactly right. And I'm seeing from your notes here that you said there were over 40 areas of concern and only 5 have been taken off that list.
That is correct.
In that period of time. So that's really an exciting and hopeful story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty big. And I hope to see more news coming out of the White Lake area soon.
Excellent. Let's go. I sense that Ed Rutherford is on the phone. Let's get ready for a little talk with him by listening to the tune Fish and Blues by Taj Mahal, which Ed actually and very astutely suggested we play.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. Your life, your sweet wife, catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. I went on down to my favorite fishing hole, baby grabbed me a pole and line. A 9-pound catfish, now you know I brought him home for supper time. Proving any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. Baby brother about to run me out of my mind. Say, can I go fishing with you? I took him on down to the fishing hole. Now, what do you think that he did do? Pull a great big fish out the bottom of the pond. Now, he laughed and jumped because he was real gone. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a-going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing. And my baby going fishing, too. Put him in the pot, baby, put him in the pan. Honey, cook him till he's nice and brown. Make a batch of buttermilk, cold.
Welcome back, WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And here we have Dr. Edward Rutherford on the phone with us. He is the research fishery biologist at NOAA, Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. And Dr. Rutherford has a PhD in marine environmental sciences. Dr. Rutherford, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Welcome to join us in the show.
We should also say that Ed teaches, Dr. Rutherford teaches courses at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, including an excellent one on fisheries conservation and management that I myself took several years ago.
That was a while ago, but thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. I learned many a good thing.
Well, I enjoyed working with you on that, and then on that seminar trip out to California.
Wow.
That was a lot of fun for a marine conservation seminar.
That was wonderful. The National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, maybe, in Santa Barbara, which is a great place. I recommend everyone should be as fortunate to be able to go there. It was lovely.
A seminar in California. What did you guys do there?
We talked about marine and Great Lakes.
Protected areas.
Yes, exactly. So there were folks from several other universities, both students and faculty, and we were working together on sharing ideas from and findings from different places and thinking about some future moves. It was great.
It seems to me that the SNRE is doing trips like that all the time, like every summer, that, you know, all students in the SNRE really have an opportunity to do things like that. Dr. Rutherford, are you still teaching that class here at U of M?
No, that was kind of a one-time deal. It was a joint seminar between the University of Michigan, SNRE, and some other universities. It was a really neat experience, I think, and things in the Great Lakes are different than elsewhere in the marine systems, but it resulted in Jennifer and some of the other students wrote up a piece that got into a book about the Great Lakes fisheries management.
I'm very, very proud of that and very happy to have that on my CV. I can't lie. Ed, what first got you interested in aquatic environments?
Well, two events. One was growing up near the shore in New England and, you know, loving being in the water. And then after college and not getting a job to be a bird biologist, I went to the University of Michigan Biological Station and took a great course on fish ecology and ended up staying in Ann Arbor for the next year or two. But realizing that I really wanted to go to graduate school and learn more about it. So that was being in Michigan and being at the bio station was what got me going.
This really ties into what we were talking 2 weeks ago about the importance of experiential learning and igniting new kinds of passions and interests that then turn into entire careers.
Yeah, I think that's the single most important thing for a student to do is to get that experience and see whether he or she likes it. And it usually turns out that one does and goes off to do other things in the field.
Have there been opportunities to study some bird and fish interactions together in your life to tie into that initial... That initial interest.
Well, actually, yes, but not. I've only been sampling fish in the field, not birds in the field. But cormorants in the Great Lakes, for example, are a great consumer of fish. And there have been several management issues related to cormorant consumption of walleye and yellow perch and getting anglers very angry about how many fish they do indeed eat.
Is that a problem for local fishermen, all the fish being eaten by birds?
Well, up in the Lacino Islands area, there's been sort of an on-again, off-again issue with cormorant consumption of birds, and also in Oneida Lake, which is a large inland lake connecting to the Erie Canal drainage into Lake Ontario, and in that lake in particular, they actually went out and destroyed cormorant eggs to reduce the breeding populations.
Oh, wow.
And reduce the consumption mortality of game fish.
So I guess it was a problem then.
Well, yeah, they did a lot of modeling work to determine how much it was affecting the population, and in fact it was affecting the survival of young fish to the adult life stage.
Okay.
And up in the Lacino Islands, a Michigan DNR biologist found essentially the same thing. So they took efforts to, I think, scare the birds off and perhaps try and reduce their breeding success.
Interesting. And cormorants are a native bird species of Michigan, correct?
Yes, they are.
Okay, it's interesting that we're dealing with them in this way, because we usually see invasive species, you know, taking out local populations of fish and things like that, and we have to deal with them. But it's interesting to see a native species being a problem.
Well, I know, and their populations have rebounded since they were protected, and which is a great thing. And as they've gotten more abundant, they've, you know, more and more of them are coming into the Great Lakes and going where the fish are. So it's an interesting policy decision to suppress a native population of birds to favor fish.
So we were just, Dave provided us an update on White Lake in western part of Michigan, and that there is plans to remove it from the list of areas of concern in the Great Lakes as formerly heavily polluted sites that have triumphantly been restored, perhaps.
That's great news. That's very exciting. I don't know much about that effort and what's been done. I know that there's been a lot of work in Muskegon Lake, which is the next big connecting lake just south of White Lake, to address the beneficial use impairments and get it off the areas of concern list. And I think there are just two beneficial use impairments remaining. So it's good news that we're actually seeing results of these restoration efforts.
Well, that's great, Dr. Rutherford. I'm not quite sure what a benefit restoration. What was it that you called it? I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, it's called a beneficial use impairment.
Beneficial use impairment. Okay.
Yeah. So when a list was made up of these areas of concern in the Great Lakes, they're usually where cities, right where these large tributaries enter the Great Lakes.
Sure.
And they've experienced, because of industrialization and paper plants and so on, they've experienced severe contamination with metals and pesticides or PCBs over the years. And so now that material is being dredged out of that area. In the case of Muskegon Lake, they're trying to remove old deposits from the sawmill, so sawmill dust that's sitting on the lake bottom. Hmm. And instead, when they've removed that, they're planting macrophytes back in and stabilizing the shoreline, which allows fish populations to come back in and then attracts larger fish, which, like walleyes, that mean it's both an aesthetic improvement but also an economic improvement.
Absolutely.
So in the case of Muskegon Lake, these such improvements have, somebody has estimated that for every dollar expended to do the restoration, there's a $6 return in the value of the of homes around Muskegon Lake. So,
wow, that's awesome.
It is awesome.
So it really benefits everyone involved.
Yes, it does. It benefits the economy. It benefits, you know, in the case of removing metals, you can feel better about the fish you eat.
Yeah, right.
And there are more fish, so that's all good.
Yeah.
Talking about the fish we eat, now it's since it's getting warmer, there's a lot more people like to go out fishing. So what are some of your favorite spots for fishing?
Yeah, well, my favorite spot is wherever somebody has a boat and they want to take me to go fishing.
So you like to get away from the shoreline.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Actually, a former member of SNRE, a former student in SNRE, has gone into done other things for a career, but he still fishes. And he's a very good fisherman, and so I've been able to go out with him about once a year in either Lake Michigan or Lake Erie to go fishing for salmon or walleyes.
Mm, that's nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in the surrounding area, are there any fish that are the healthiest to eat, or are there any fish that we absolutely should not eat?
Well, the general rule of thumb is the smaller fish that you eat, the better off you are, because they haven't, it's, you know, they haven't accumulated as much contaminants over their lifespan. For some species of fish, like lake trout, which are delicious to eat, but that's because they have a lot of lipids. And so, again, the smaller size you eat, the better, but they're PCB contamination has gone down quite a bit over the years. Unfortunately, the levels of mercury in the ecosystem and in these fish has gone up. And so really, the leaner the species of fish, the probably the better off you are in terms of being able to eat them, and also the smaller the fish.
Of course, we don't want to be eating juveniles.
Ideally,
that's
probably illegal.
Yeah.
But extra delicious, the veal of fish.
Yeah.
Along that note, in thinking about the many challenges the Great Lakes face, but also some of the wonderful positive developments that have been happening, I think we should go to a tune briefly, and then we'll come back, Ed, and talk about your work with invasive species, if that's all right for you.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Cool.
Thanks.
So this tune is called The Great Lakes Prayer, and it's by a gentleman named Russ Franzen.
There's so much on these lakes for us to enjoy, but it's a system that's fragile and can be destroyed. There are birds in the air and plants on the shore and all living creatures that need our support. In each of these lakes, let the waters run pure, let her fish be plenty, all her wildlife on shore. Let each as a steward give more than we take, and do all in our power to keep these great lakes. For so many years, these lakes we've abused, dumping garbage and chemicals that we have used. But these lakes can be clean if we all do our part, and it's with you and me that it all has to start. In each of these lakes, let the waters run pure, let her fish be plenty, all her wildlife on shore. Let each as a steward give more than we take, and do all in our power to keep these great lakes. We stand on the beach, looking out o'er the waves on this great inland waterway called the Great Lakes. We come here to fish, we come here to rest, we give thanks as we stand here, we truly are blessed. In each of these lakes, let the waters run pure, let her fish be plenty, all her wildlife on shore. Let each as a steward give more than we take, and do all in our power to keep these great lakes.
There you go. Welcome back. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is As Hot in Here. I'm David Clive. I'm joined by Jennifer Johnson and Pearl Zhang. And Dr. Edward Rutherford is on the phone. And Ed, earlier you, in your emails, mentioned to us that a lot of your work concerns invasive species in the Great Lakes and the pollution that they bring in. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So just as excessive land use practices can degrade the health of habitats and fish populations, the biological form of pollution comes in a form of invasive species, and the Great Lakes have been a sort of a postcard for the impact of invasive species on food webs. Probably one of the greatest and most harmful invaders has been the quagga mussel, which entered the Great Lakes in the mid-1990s, and in Lake Michigan in particular, just exploded in numbers around 2002, 2003, and it's just dramatically changed the food web.
Now, is that the same thing as a zebra mussel, or are they different?
It's related. The zebra mussel is came in a little bit earlier and inhabits the nearshore zone. The quagga mussel is a sort of a deeper water form in that family, and it can live out to the middle of to the deepest parts of these lakes. And they're very efficient filters of the water column. So the impacts they've had is to put a lot of energy on the bottom of the lakes and also retain energy and nutrients in the nearshore zone. And so what's happened is the formerly the productive planktonic food web has declined dramatically, with the result that alewife populations and rainbow smelt populations that formerly were food for salmon and supported the salmon fishery have declined, and in Lake Huron, the salmon that are left are routinely migrate over to Lake Michigan in search of pelagic prey. And there's great concern that in Lake Michigan right now that the alewife population will crash. Salmon fisheries in both lakes are extremely valuable. They really support the $1 billion+ a year recreational fishery in the Great Lakes. So our lab is interested in, and our mission is to sort of understand what the impacts of the quagga mussels and other invasive species, predaceous spiny water flea, in particular, have had on the lower food web, which supports the early survival and growth of young fish.
Interesting. What kind of effects does the goby have on local populations and things like that? Because as a fisherman, that is the invasive species that I encounter most often when I'm
right.
fishing for other species of fish. You know, and I know that you're not supposed to put them back in, but what kinds of effects does it have on its environment?
Yeah, well, the gobies are very aggressive, and they have displaced some native species of darters. These are small fishes, beautiful fishes that live in rocky areas in rivers. And so they've displaced those, but they with the explosion of the quagga mussels, the round goby came from the same habitats as the quagga mussels, and they are adapted to feed on quagga mussels. So,
interesting.
They, with the demise of the planktonic food web, and with the energy in the food and in these lakes being directed towards the benthos, the bottom of the food web, mm-hmm. The gobies are the one species that, because they consume a lot of these mussels, they're available for predators like lake trout to feed upon. And so it's fortunate, given the mussels are here, that there is some food web link to the higher trophic levels. So they're kind of just as the alewife were, first a curse and then, given the change in the food web, actually a blessing.
Yeah, that's interesting how one invasive species is kind of curbing the effects of another one, really.
Yes, yeah, it is really interesting.
Is there anything that we can do as fishermen or just people that enjoy water sports to help with these invasive species problems?
Well, especially anglers. There are several ways in which you can help. The first is to, whenever you take a boat into or out of a lake, to thoroughly wash it off, and there are procedures you can use to, put a little bleach in the water that you're using to wash down your boat so that you kill larvae of invasive species that may be in your bilge water or, taken into the boat when you're driving around. And that's a really important thing to do. The other is to, anglers are very observant of what they catch and where they catch it, or
keep an
eye on new invasive species. So, the Asian carps are poised to enter the Great Lakes.
I've been hearing about that for a while now.
Yeah, so it's very important to kind of, if you see something that you've never seen before, just call up a local DNR office and mm-hmm. tell them about it. Because once these species get in and get established, there's virtually no way of getting rid of them, except if you're lucky, you can apply some chemical treatments like they do with sea lamprey. But the time to really suppress them is immediately, as soon as they get in and their populations haven't grown. Trying to get rid of species when they first established has been successful, actually, for the Eurasian ruff in parts of places in Lake Huron before they've gotten established. So, those two ways, and then also internet trading of fish. I know people love to have fish in aquaria.
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
right.
It's a good practice not to dump fish in a local lake when you're done with them. If you are done with them, give them to a friend, or else, kill them before you release them.
And it's a somber thing, but it must be done sometimes.
Right.
Interesting.
Wow. Well, it's phenomenal the work that NOAA and other yourself and research scientists at the University of Michigan and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources have been able to do to track and try to understand and manage these very, very complex situations in many places.
Well, there's a lot of very exciting work going on. Some folks at University of Notre Dame developed this environmental DNA technique where you can take a sample of water and know what species of fish has been in that water,
Whoa.
At least over a short period of time.
Oh.
And so that allows that now allows managers to and biologists to go to an area and monitor for the presence of species that are anticipated to enter the Great Lakes The other thing that's been going on with, again, led by some scientists at University of Notre Dame, is to make, and also the University of Michigan, is to make predictions about where young life stages of these species will go, either being released by shipping or being dispersed naturally by lake currents. And so that helps managers focus on areas to sample, you know, likely locations where these new species will show up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's some crazy technology. Huh?
Yeah, my mind is blown that you can have a bit of water and know what fish swim.
Well, you know, so the idea came from a scientist, Lindsay Chatterton, who's at the Nature Conservancy. Hmm. And he's kind of a out-of-the-box thinker. And he said, well, what if we could fingerprint fish, you know, invasive species? Can we do that? And then some of the geneticists that he works with actually came up with a technique to do that.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you've been involved with a lot of GIS work as well. With
I have to really take my hat off to the group at University of Michigan, SRE, that Catherine Rising, who's a research scientist there, is leading an effort called the Great Lakes Aquatic Habitat Framework that's putting together all these GIS layers that are available for Lake Michigan and actually creating new ones that will not only allow classification of lake habitats, but also, in the case of invasive species, allow better prediction of where a new invader will go, you know, what would be a suitable habitat out there versus not.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. David Allen has led the Great Lakes, and I'm forgetting the acronym, what the acronym means, but it's the GLEAM project.
Mm.
And it's a project to identify stressors on the aquatic ecosystems, both from the watersheds and the open lakes. And it's a neat project because it allows you to identify the cumulative stress, and it's all through mapping on a particular area of the lake, or you can pull out individual stressors and look at what that particular stress has on a lake and its food web.
Good. It sounds like we're going to need these new pieces of technology in the future to really combat these invasive species that are coming at us from all angles.
Yeah, well, it's the neat thing is that these databases and layers are now becoming available, mm-hmm. and it allows others to add to them or do studies and understand, you know, sort of on the landscape what else is going on. We've had that ability for the watersheds for a long time, but it's now just available for the Great Lakes.
Good stuff.
It's a beautiful thing. Well, Ed, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us today. We've learned a great deal.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been fun to talk to you, and best wishes for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Rutherford. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Okay. More
you
soon.
You too.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye. Perhaps we'll play the Fish in the Dish song by Sharon Jones right now, because that's a positive one about fish in the dish. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be joined by Dr. Solomon David, a current postdoctoral fellow with the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago.
I got a fish in my dish, and I'm feeling fine. I got a fish in my dish, and I know it's mine. I remember when an old man
All right. That was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings with Fish in the Dish. It's a very exciting moment when you've got that fish in your dish and you're feeling fine. And we're feeling extra fine now because Dr. Solomon David is joining us from the Shedd Aquarium.
Thank you, Jen.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you.
Oh, thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So you've been at the Shedd Aquarium since 2012. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what have you been working on there?
All kinds of stuff. So at Shedd Aquarium, I'm a postdoctoral research associate there and also co-supervised by University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I do make trips back and forth to Madison there. But I'm working on Great Lakes migratory fishes research. And this is just one series of projects within the Daniel P. Harther Center for Conservation and Research at Shedd Aquarium. So they've got several on-the-ground field research projects going. And I'm looking at, again, Great Lakes migratory fishes and those fishes essentially that connect Great Lakes habitats within the broader Great Lakes ecosystem. So when you're thinking about the Great Lakes, they're actually made up of a diversity of habitat types from the lakes proper to rivers, streams, inland lakes, and wetlands. And migratory fishes can be important because they connect those various habitats. And so they can tell us a lot about the health of the overall ecosystem.
That is fascinating because so often we're used to thinking of these things as bounded.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
But it's these fish that also can help us think in new ways about them.
Sure. I mean, you know, you think about the sort of interconnectivity of, you know, just everything, really, if you think about it. But, you know, within the context of the Great Lakes, it's not just Lake Michigan or Lake Erie or Lake Huron. I mean, mm-hmm. there's several different habitats connecting those, you know, that broader ecosystem. And it helps to have sort of environmental indicators or organisms we can look at to gauge that health of that ecosystem, especially when that's where all of our drinking water comes from, a lot of, you know, commerce, that sort of stuff. So those fish that travel between those various habitats can actually be quite valuable in terms of, you know, indicating overall ecosystem help.
So I am on the Shedd Aquarium's website right now, and okay. there are two amazing things about it. One, well, there's many, many, many amazing things about it. But one is they call you an aquatic sleuth, which I love. And on the article that's talking about it is a photo from my master's class SNRE electrofishing tour.
Yeah.
I'm like, I might actually be in this picture.
Yeah, it's very possible. I mean, if you remember, we did the orientation at School of Natural Resources and Environment, which is, you know, where I did my graduate work. And I got to say, it was great to follow up Ed Rutherford out of NOAA GLURL, who was my master's advisor and on my PhD committee. So, I mean, you know, it's great to be talking to you guys and kind of bring it back to SNRE that way.
It's a nice kind of love fest moment. I think I am in this photo, but this isn't about me. So what does it mean to be an aquatic sleuth?
Well, you know, I think that's a fancier way of talking about what we do, you know, in science. It was funny because a colleague of mine, Dr. Eric Larson, mm-hmm. Had mentioned last week, he said, well, sometimes science is just flipping over rocks. So that doesn't have the same sort of appeal to it as maybe aquatic sleuth, but there's a lot of the nitty-gritty science that, you know, actually gets things done. And so I think aquatic sleuth is sort of a way of, you know, talking about how we're trying to solve these various mysteries of what's going on out there. And so a couple of our projects kind of fit that framework. One of my projects is looking at the reemergence of Lake Whitefish migration. So the Lake Whitefish is a Great Lakes native species, and it's a member of the salmon family, but a little bit different in how it looks. And it's actually the most important commercial fishery in the Great Lakes. And like salmon, they would migrate upstream to spawn, but unlike salmon, they don't die after spawning. They are repeat spawners. And up until about 100 years ago, Lake Whitefish would migrate from the Great Lakes proper up into tributaries along the Great Lakes. Unfortunately, due to sawmill pollution and the inherent habitat loss, those migrations ceased. But then about 5 to 10 years ago, anglers started noticing that Lake Whitefish were coming back into these tributaries, and it slowly increased over the past 5 to 10 years. And so we're looking at, you know, the reemergence of this Great Lakes migration and, you know, what that means for the Great Lakes. And, you know, more specifically, can we tell the difference between river-spawning Lake Whitefish and lake-spawning Lake Whitefish to explain maybe why this huge life history switch took place and how we can manage those populations to sort of keep native species coming back.
It's an incredibly important fish. It's an incredibly delicious fish.
Mm-hmm.
I just got some nice smoked whitefish from the Bayport Fish Company at the Ann Arbor Farmers Market.
Oh, nice.
I recommend everyone go there. You don't have to be jealous. Just go tomorrow and get yourself a piece.
Nice.
It's cheaper if you get the bone in, which I did.
Okay.
Because, you know, I can pick out bones of fish. It doesn't gross me out. But they do have non-boned versions for folks to enjoy.
Good to know.
I definitely don't check out the farmer's market enough. I'll have to go.
Yeah, do it. Reemergence is one of my favorite words and concepts, actually. This idea that things can go away, we assume that they'll never come back again. But here there are new migrations and whitefish places where they haven't been before. That has to be so exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of a positive story when you think about, you know, all the problems with invasive species and, you know, potentially invasive species around the Chicago area. Of course, we hear a lot about the silver and bighead carp, more collectively called, you know, Asian carp, mm-hmm. even though several species make up the Asian carp complex. But it's nice to know about, you know, a native species that's sort of making a comeback and making a rebound. Another cool thing about the whitefish is that they've found that they're actually eating zebra and quagga mussels in some areas, and they've even found round gobies in the stomach and even alewives to an extent. So it's kind of neat in that you've got this sort of native species that's making a comeback but sort of, you know, taking it out on invasive species as well.
Wow.
We love to see that, really.
Yeah, it's like a native savior or something. Something wonderful. Do you think, I don't know if this is a fair question, do you think that whitefish populations have changed their feeding habits to be able, or certain behaviors to be able to consume the quagga mussels?
We definitely think so. And, you know, I'm speaking from the, you know, the collective research of a lot of different scientists. So, mm-hmm. you know, with my time in Ann Arbor, it was great to work with a lot of different agencies. And now at Shedd Aquarium, being able to network with a lot of people. So a lot of other Great Lakes scientists have done this research. And so we've sort of put that together. But it does look like they are changing behaviors. I mean, if you think about it, zebra and quagga mussels have eliminated a lot of the macroinvertebrates, some of the bugs that were there that whitefish were normally feeding on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, fish and nature as a whole is, you know, is resilient. And so they're changing their ways to eat what's available, and they've been able to adapt to eating these zebra and quagga mussels and some of these other invasive species. Sometimes because the food just isn't there, but, you know, also because that's what's most plentiful right now are these invasive species in some areas. But it's kind of neat that, you know, these fishes will adapt, and just like their sort of reemergence here, they will come back. Like, we expect that, you know, the Clean Water Act going into effect in the 70s and sort of restoring the habitat over time, you know, if we restore it, it seems like the fishes will come back.
That's the best thing I've heard in a really long time.
Go whitefish.
I love it. So we are going to listen to a little bit of a tune first. Solomon has dedicated much of his intellectual energies, in addition to caring about Great Lakes migratory species, particularly caring about the ancient gar fishes, which are fabulous looking. If you're by a computer right now, just look up a gar. They have these just phenomenal long noses, almost reminiscent of an alligator or a crocodile, but on a fish's body. And you got to think that that thing must have come in handy in the past and must still come in handy to be able to continue to exist. So I'd love to hear more about your passions for garfishes after we listen to this 1947 tune called Eyes Are Ganes, which is by a gal, Joanna Georgia Kopoulou. I believe she is Greek. This is about garfishes. So Zarganes are garfishes. It's a song about garfishes.
Awesome.
Let's hear it.
Ψιψιπούλες και οι γλωσσοκοπάνες και ο σελέτης γειτονιάς σου οι ζεργάνες σ' έχουν γεμίσει με καπνούς πια το κεφάλι κι έτσι ξεχνάς την πρώτη αγάπη για μια άλλη σ' έχουν γεμίσει με καπνούς πια το κεφάλι κι έτσι ξεχνάς την πρώτη αγάπη για μια άλλη. Thank you. άλλαξε θελώσει. Τότε θα νιώσει το κακό που έχει κάνει. Μα θα είναι αργά γιατί ο καημός μου θα έχει γιάνει. Τότε θα νιώσει το κακό που έχει κάνει. Μα θα είναι αργά γιατί ο καημός μου θα έχει γιάνει. Αργάνες δίνεις βάση κι έτσι ό,τι εκτίσαμε κυριό μας θα χαλάσει. Στις γειτονιά σου τις αργάνες δίνεις βάση κι έτσι ό,τι εκτίσαμε κυριό μας θα χαλάσει. Στις γειτονιά σου τα ψιψίμι δίνεις βάση. Γιατί ό,τι χτίσαμε κυριό μας τα χαλάσει. Στις γειτονιά σου τα ψιψίμι δίνεις βάση. Γιατί ό,τι χτίσαμε κυριό μας τα χαλάσει.
The garfishes were so delicious that this woman sang an entire song about it. Solomon, what excites you so much about the garfishes?
I don't know. That song definitely does, because that's got to be the first song I've ever heard, you know, specifically about gars
there's
and
a,
everything.
There's
you know.
A couple more. I'll send you links. I was doing some research.
Nice. I'm going to have to get that playlist then and stuff, because I feel like, you know, there's the gar songs that go around in my head all the time, but that's just because I've got a problem. But I guess to get to your question, what was it again to, you know, what's interesting about gars?
Mm.
I guess, you know, I could obviously go on and on about that sort of thing. But my graduate work at University of Michigan, SNRE, did focus on a particular species of gar that was found in the Great Lakes region called the spotted gar, which extends all the way down to Mexico. But more broadly speaking, I mean, gars are fascinating to me because they're this sort of primitive, for lack of a better term, species or a group of fishes that have been around and haven't changed much since even the dinosaur times. And so they look like you said earlier. They look like a crocodile or an alligator with fins instead of legs. They've got this elongate snout with a lot of teeth. When I was a kid, I was interested in dinosaurs, and so upon seeing a gar for the first time actually in a Ranger Rick magazine, which is where I saw an alligator gar, that like really sort of hooked my interest right away there. I thought, like, this is a fish that's been around since the dinosaurs. It looks really cool, and, you know, it's still here today. And, you know, eventually, fast forward to decades later, I was able to convince people like Dr. Ed Rutherford and my committee at University of Michigan to be able to study those fish, and it's been a great opportunity to be able to still incorporate some of the work with those fish into my current work at Shedd Aquarium. So that's been really exciting for me.
Does that big old snout help the fish eat, or what function does it serve?
You know, other than looking cool, for sure.
It does look super
cool.
Do you think they know?
It helps with the way they feed. So you've got a more extended range, and most gars are going to be fish eaters. Some of them will also eat crayfish and other invertebrates, and really whatever they can get a hold of. And so it sort of extends the range of what they can sort of grab at. And so those teeth aren't made for really cutting and tearing like a piranha's jaws would be, but they're for grasping and holding. So what they do is they snatch a fish or whatever the prey is sideways really quickly, and then they'll usually change it, adjust it over till it goes head first and then down the hatch. And, you know, that's just kind of what they do. They're the apex predators in a lot of different habitats, and they can help by controlling forage fish populations and other fish populations from getting out of control. Another thing I should throw in is that recent studies done in Illinois and I think through other areas in the Great Lakes region have found that gars actually really like eating Asian carp. So if you're looking at another sort of native species to combat an invasive species, they're one of those fish that has this sort of, you know, potentially unending appetite. They're quick growers, but they eat them at the earlier stages, so when the Asian carp are smaller. And so that's usually when you want to hit a lot of these fish, is when they're at those early stages.
Have you observed any gar eating in the wild like you described to us?
Oh, definitely. Gars are also unique in that, with a unique group of species, in that they're air breathers. So they go up to the surface and they take gulps of air. So they've got
pretty easy to locate
structure
them.
Inside of them that works kind of like a lung does in mm-hmm. other vertebrates. And so they have to go up to the surface to gulp air. So when you that sort of makes them easier to observe when you're looking for them feeding too, because a lot of times they'll feed at the surface. I'd be remiss if I said I didn't have some as pets back in the day. what was really great is that when I was leaving Ann Arbor, Shedd Aquarium didn't have any gars on exhibit at the time, so I was actually able to bring over some research specimens from my Michigan work, and now they're on exhibit at the Great Lakes Gallery and a couple other spots at Shedd Aquarium. So it's kind of been neat to, again, literally bring that aspect of my research over to Shedd with me.
That's so wonderful. And I think all of the gar, if I can speak for them, are so happy that you have worked so hard to raise attention.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's been a struggle, and, they're oftentimes looked at as trash fish or, you know, causing problems for game fishes. But then research has shown, and slowly, you know, some other areas of, angler interest over the years have shown that, like, you know, they can actually benefit native sport fish populations and actually provide an ecosystem service overall. So I think showing that native species, no matter what species it is or what the, if it's a sport fish or a non-game fish, can have value to humans and also from a biodiversity standpoint as well.
Do people call you the gar whisperer?
You know, it depends. I think people just say I've got gar problems and everything like that. But, I'm happy with whatever moniker comes attached to the gars. I've learned to accept that part of it.
And your Facebook feed over the years has been full of excellent sort of gar puns, regardless, and all of these nice allusions.
It's hard to get away from, and so I just kind of embrace that set.
Exactly. I don't think it's a problem.
You have a gargantuan love.
Exactly.
For those fish.
It's catchy, see? You know, you guys are already wrapped up into it.
Yeah, my mind is racing to find others, and it's failing. But that's my own problem. I don't think you have a gar problem. I think you have a deep love and interest for gars.
Thank you.
Have you ever eaten one?
I definitely have. Down in Mexico, they actually aquaculture the species down there called the tropical gar, and it's a big part of the culture down in the Tabasco state of Mexico. And so they eat gar down there the same way that we eat salmon in the Pacific Northwest. And so they culture them there. They've actually started aquaculturing them to take pressure off of native populations. That way they don't become overfished. And they're also using that to restock populations that have been depleted. And I've also had them down in the south. As you go farther south, people are a little bit more prone to eating gar and a little bit more willing to eat it. Not that they don't up here, but we don't have as many gars up here as we do down in the south. So I've had alligator gar and spotted gar and some of the other species. And I've got to say it's delicious. So there's not a whole lot of bone on the inside. For, you know, fish that, like, looks as prehistoric as they are, the bone is all on the outside. So as long as you can get through that hide, you've got a lot of meat on them. You know, they're usually a relatively plentiful fish in the right areas. And so, you know, I've been a proponent of, you know, using them as a food fish as well.
Excellent. Now I'm incredibly hungry, which is good because our show is ending and now we can all go find fish, get your fishing rods.
Exactly.
Catch a fish, skin it, gut it, cook it, eat it. That sounds good. Hey, Solomon, thank you so much for all the work you've done, but especially today for taking the time to speak with us.
No, thank you. It's great. It's great speaking with all of you guys.
It's so rare that I ever talk about fish in a, well, not, there's so many, there's an abundance of negative stories about fisheries. Global fisheries are tanking, all these things. But then to have these positive stories coming out of the Great Lakes region is really exciting and refreshing. For me.
Go White Lake.
Go White Lake. Go White Fish. Go Shedd Aquarium. Go
yeah.
NOAA.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Solomon. And we will talk in the future. I would love to hear more about your work.
Sounds great. Looking forward
Thanks,
to
Solomon.
It. Happy to be here, too.
Okay. Excellent. Will you take care? And as we sign off, I'd like to thank our engineer, Cameron, for keeping us going, pushing all the right buttons at all the right times. I don't think I could do that myself.
You wouldn't be hearing us without him.
Yes, so thank you to Cameron Bothner for that. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and this has been It's Hot in Here. I have been and will remain Jennifer Johnson.
I am David Clive.
I'm Pearl Dang.
And we have been very happy to bring you the show today. We wish you a wonderful weekend. Hopefully tomorrow will be sunny and lovely and we can all enjoy it. Until then, maybe go fishing in the dark, in the nighttime. This is a tune that we're going to take you out on. Who does this song? The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. That's who.
Love it.
Awesome.
Lazy yellow moon coming up tonight, shining through the trees. Crickets are singing and lightning bugs are floating on the breeze. Baby, get ready. Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stump road, I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready. Summer's coming, the days are getting long.